Early this week, the International Olympic Games in Munich were interrupted by violence and terror that resulted in the deaths of 11 members of the Israeli Olympic team. Although much of this week's public response was directly related to the Munich slayings, our discussion tonight will probably only touch upon that incident. The major concern, at least as this reporter here sees it, is how incidents such as this force those who feel closely involved and personally affected to sort out their personal feelings. It seems appropriate that on this eve of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, that such a discussion of attitudes and feelings be aired. Paul Grucco of the KSJN news staff is here with me, Connie Goldman, to talk with our guests, who are Mrs. Herbert Joshua, the Twin Cities chairman of the 25th anniversary celebration of the State of Israel, Mr. Marvin Pertzik, president of the St. Paul United Jewish Fund and Council, and Mr. Misha Penn, assistant professor of humanities at the University of Minnesota. Well, at this time, stimulated by the horror at Munich, the beginning of the new year by the Jewish calendar, and the continuing unrest in the Mideast, what are the feelings of the Twin City Jewish community? No man speaks for all men, but some feelings are held by many. Can we begin today by having all of you here respond to a portion of an interview that I taped shortly after the hostages were reported killed in Munich? These are the opinions of Minneapolis businessman Jerome Pearl.
It isn't just a matter of the death of 11 Israelis. I mean, there's Israelis who are dying at the borders every day, I'm sure. But it's the... I think it really incenses me is that I guess it just points up how hard it is to be a Jew. And that's going to be forever and ever. It has been forever and ever, and God damn it, I just don't see any end to it. If you're a Jew, and no matter where you live, there's somebody gunning for you. Maybe you sound a little paranoid, but to go to the Olympic Games, which is, you know, apolitical type of thing, and you look at the team and you see where the team, they come from Russia, they come from Poland, they come from all over, you know, but the one common denominator comes down to one point, that they're a Jew. And it just really ticks me off that fact, and that fact alone, is the reason that they're dead. There's no question there's a Palestinian cause, and there's no question that they're, in my mind anyhow, that there is an injustice to a certain degree. And, you know, not laying the blame at the feet of the Israelis or at the feet of the Arab countries or how the problem became. You raise the issue of the Palestinian Arabs? Yeah, sure. This is, to me, is the utter frustration that I started out to tell you in the beginning of this whole thing. When and how can it end? It can't end. There is no end. You got 1 million Palestinian Arabs or more, and you have an almost insolvable problem. The United Nations partitioned the land. The Jews were given their little part. They didn't even have the most holiest of places to the Jews. That was Jerusalem. That was in the hands of the Palestinian Arabs. So the Jews had a fight in 48, and they lost. They really lost. They didn't win. They already were given by the United Nations. The partition was granted. They had a fight for their survival. Again in 1956, and again in 1967. But how many times do you have to get hit in the head before you get the message? Before the Jews all over the world get the message? This incident in Munich, the massacre in Munich, makes the message very clear. And if there's any Jew or anyone who has any feelings towards the Jewish people, whether they're Israelis or not, this should give them the message of what I'm trying to tell you. The Jews are dispensable. Who's right and who's wrong? They're not going to settle it this way. This is, again, points up to what I'm saying about being a Jew. It comes right back to the same thing. They finally say, okay, Jew, here's your land. You know, the world is being magnanimous. You know, okay, you lost 6 million of your brethren, so consequently, here's a little piece of desert. You know, go make it bloom. Here's the sand. You know, we'll find some water and irrigate it and grow something. And the Jews say, fine, great, we'll call it Israel and we'll build here and we'll make it grow and we'll work hard. And, you know, you think that's the end of it. They got their country, they got a couple of million people there, but that's not where it ends. So somebody fights and the Jews end up with more sand. In the meantime, all the established countries, the Arab countries, Egypt and Syria and Iraq, and they continue to say, we're not going to let you live, Jew. You know, you're going to go into the sea. We're going to push you into the sea. So, you know, I don't think it's really a question of, I mean, the action in Munich isn't a, I don't know if Sadat said, go ahead and kill the Israeli Olympic team and become a bunch of heroes. I don't think it was that. And regardless, they are, to coin a cliche, they're murderers. And, you know, I mean, we all know what the action involved, but, and we call them fanatics. But the futility, better they would say, okay, there's 11 of us and there's 11 of you, and let's fight it out in mortal combat. I think the Israelis would have accepted the challenge instead of, you know, skulking in and just senseless killing. I mean, the 11 deaths are not going to destroy the state of Israel. If anything else, it's, you know, all these things are going to strengthen the people. We found that out in our own history of what happens when we attack another country. You unify people when you attack and you mercilessly and senselessly kill. But it comes back to that one point. I mean, I sit and I look at the books in my library, While 6 Million Died, Trials at the Nuremberg Trials, Exodus, just endless number of books about, you know, about a few million people who constitute a minute portion of the population of this world. And for one reason, because they're Jews. That's all. That's the reason that... You know, I mean, if Israel was so valuable, if they had the oil and they had all the tremendous natural resources, I can understand somebody wanting to go after them. But what do they want to go after them for? What are they going to get? Tel Aviv? Haifa? Sand? Desert? You know, take over some kibbutzim that, to me, is a complete enigma. The act at Munich is just another grain of that sand in the time jar that says that Jews, you're never going to know any peace. You know, that people say, well, maybe some good will come out of this, the killing in Munich. Maybe it'll bring the family of nations together. That's a bunch of bullshit. You know, we've been living with this family of nations crap. Every Christmas I hear it. You know, peace on earth, goodwill towards men. That seems to be fine for a few days a year. The one valid point is that nobody really likes a Jew when you get right down to it. And, you know, if this is our cross to bear, we bear it, you know, and our forefathers bore it, and we'll bear it. But I tell you, I feel like that early American flag that said, don't tread on me. Well, this is one Jew that doesn't want to stand for that shit, and I'm really not going to. I said before, you know, maybe it's a little paranoid, but God Almighty, where does it stop? When does it end? What would have happened if all 12,000 athletes had marched with their country's banner? I don't know how many hundreds of countries are represented, had marched to that compound where the Arabs were holding, and then let the television cameras focus on that, and let these 12,000 athletes in one voice say, give us these people. These people are athletes. They're not soldiers fighting a war here. Wouldn't that... I mean, to me as a Jew, that would have boosted my faith by some unknown quantity. I think probably for the first time in my life, I would have felt that, my God, they finally care. They finally care enough so that blacks, Asians, whites from all over the world marched to that compound and said, give us those men. This is no place for that. You want to meet him? Meet him on the desert in Sinai. That would have been something. But they didn't do that. They expressed regret, and I'm sure they were regretful. I'm not putting that down. But where is it going to end?
Well, does anyone here have feelings about what that man expressed? Are they any of your feelings? What might you say? Mrs. Joshua?
Well, I don't really agree with him, although I can understand that at that particular time when he talked, he felt very depressed. I have a much more positive outlook, I must say. It's true, incidents like this do happen in Jewish history, but we have a capacity to build from that and build on it, and I think that's the important part that he left out.
Well, I tend to agree with Mrs. Joshua. I think the feelings expressed by Mr. Pearl do have some basis in history. I think as we review the history of Jews over the past 2,000 years and review the persecutions over this period of time, possibly we Jews are a bit, as we've been called, a bit paranoid. But I think it's a paranoia based in sense on history. However, I think we have to look at the situation within the concept of the within the context of the Arab-Israeli dispute of the past 25 years. I think really to go much beyond that overly distorts the issue. I think there are some historical factors which are pertinent, but I think that possibly we should confine the historical situation to what's happened since 48.
And I think I agree with Mr. Pritzig, and Mr. Pearl's comments point up an interesting generational gap, I think. That is, the Jew in America seeing himself as isolated, as in some sense cut off, stateless. So Mr. Pearl poignantly plaintively, that is, asks when will it end? And as I recall, he at one point said that nobody likes a Jew. One gets this feeling, that is, of the rootlessness of the Jew from his comments. But of course, that has changed. The state of Israel has given the Jew roots. It has given him given him a voice, an international voice. And I think one must look at the situation in the context of the political relationship between the Jew and the Arab.
Well, before we get too deep into this, I'd like to introduce another element for your consideration. Please forgive the intrusion because your enthusiasm and interest in the subject is high, but let me play for you one other recorded segment, this one also recorded very shortly after the announcement of the Munich massacre. These are the concerns of Martin Dworkin, a professor of microbiology at the University of Minnesota.
I want to clear the air first of some possible misconceptions about myself and my prejudices and my position. I'm a Jew. I'm a Jew who's very aware and concerned about his ethnic identity. I'm not what has been called a self-hating Jew. I consider that the Jews who were killed in Munich are my brothers, and anything that I say has to be viewed against that as a background. Apart from all of the cliches that have been expressed and all of the things that have been said over and over again on television, I think there are two points that have to be made and have to be made clearly. First, the business about the politicization of the Olympics. And I think that the claims that have been made, the self-righteous claims that have been made, protesting this act of stupid violence, are at best naive and at worst dishonest, in the sense that the Olympics are political, they have been for a long time, and anybody who claims that they're not is misleading the public. Whether one refers to the behavior of the African states, whether one refers to the attempts of the Russians or the United States to use the Olympics for political purposes, one has to accept the fact that they are a political exercised. Now, this is not to in any way condone the senseless, stupid murder that has been perpetrated, but only to clear away this notion that the Olympics somehow transcend the arena of politics. I think there are very few things in the world today which do transcend it, and the Olympics is certainly one of them which doesn't. Right, that's point number one. Now, point number two, I'm very concerned about the tentative and as yet unproductive attempts which have been made to arrive at some sort of accommodation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. I think that the Israelis have shown a considerable amount of intransigence, a considerable reluctance to recognize the fact that there is such a thing called the Palestinian people, and that they, along with the Israeli people, have to be recognized as a people, and an accommodation has to be made for them. One of the tragedies of an event like this is that it makes coming back to a discussion of this sort of thing even more difficult, if not impossible. I mean, who can stand up at this moment and say the Israelis have got to talk to the Palestinians? And the tragedy is that what has happened not because of the actions of the Palestinians as a whole, but has happened because of the actions of a group of militant world revolutionaries who don't reflect in any sense the will of the Palestinian people. Now, I know, as sure as I know my own name, I know that the response of American Jewry is going to be to become even more closed-minded than they have been in the past to arriving at any kind of accommodation in this problem. And that, to me, seems to be almost equal with the tragedy of these nine Israelis being killed. But dealing with that doesn't preclude them also dealing with the larger problem. I mean, one is a tactical problem, the other is a strategic problem. And they certainly have the know-how and the capability of dealing with guerrillas and dealing with guerrilla bases. And the act of doing so need not blind them to the continuing necessity of searching for ways to deal with the larger Palestinian people. Now, we started out talking about, I started out talking about the reaction of American Jews. Now we're talking about Israeli Jews. I feel there's much less I can do about the way the Israelis react to the problem because Israel is their country, not mine. But I am concerned about how my fellow Jews here in the United States react to it. And that's one of the things that I want to emphasize in our discussion here.
Well, I know that you feel that very few American Jews would feel particularly at this time as you do, and certainly even some that may be hesitant to express it, because any sympathy for a legitimate Palestinian claim, it just seems inappropriate to dwell on it at this time for many.
Yes, I think that there's going to have to be a certain period of time during which we get this deep sadness out of our systems, at least temporarily. I don't think the Jew will ever get the sadness out of his system, but there'll have to be a period of time during which the shock, the trauma, and the sadness of these murders diminishes. And until that happens, it's going to be very difficult for anybody to stand up and say, but look through this terrible thing that happened and let's talk about what's behind it. Psychologically, that's just a very difficult thing to do at this moment.
You seem to have great fear that if the Israeli government doesn't deal with the Palestinian problem in a realistic way, as you see it, that there isn't going to be a chance of a peaceful settlement in the Mideast.
I think that's the crux of all of the problems in the Mideast. I think that despite arguments to the contrary, which I've had with friends of mine who are Israelis, I feel that the problem is not with Egypt, the problem is not with Jordan, the problem is not with Lebanon, the problem is with the Palestinians. And if the Israelis were to solve the problem of the Palestinians, then the other territorial difficulties which they have with their neighbors and which many nations have with their neighbors would fall into place. I think it's a distraction, I think, and perhaps a deliberate distraction for the Israelis continually to keep harping on the border problems with the Arab nations and to refuse to consider in any serious way the problems of the Palestinians.
What do you mean by a deliberate distraction? Whom are they deliberately distracting?
I think they're deliberately distracting their own people. They're deliberately distracting the Jews in the diaspora, who have, I think, an important spiritual and financial role to play in the state of Israel.
It doesn't seem acceptable for a good Jew to take your position. At least it hasn't. There hasn't been room for this position in the past. You want to make some observations on that?
Yes. First, I want to agree with your observation. I think that the position of the Jewish Defense League, despite the apparent condemnations or the outward condemnations of many Jews, I mean, it simply isn't fashionable to support the JDL. I think there's a lurking admiration and a latent sympathy for the sort of position that the JDL reflects, at the expense of the position on the other side of the spectrum, which is a position I'm trying to reflect, that the solution to the problem is not this kind of mindless violence which strikes out against the symptoms, but rather some kind of thoughtful attempt to redress the basic problem itself. I think that it has become increasingly difficult for the American Jew to display any kind of sympathy for this latter position. Perhaps one of the reasons is that this has been a peculiar byproduct of this heightened awareness of one's ethnic dignity and one's ethnic identity. To the extent that one accepts the idea that black is beautiful or Jewish is beautiful, I think one has a tendency to lose some of the more universal imperatives. I think this is what has been happening now.
It seems to me that we've heard here a couple of rather distinct points of view. On the one hand, the point of view that what's at the heart of the problem symbolized by Munich is an almost insurmountable ethnic prejudice on the part of the people of the world against Jews, and the second, the point of view that the problem with that is represented by the Munich tragedy is a political problem in large part, a problem that in which Israel needs to seek some kind of political accommodation with the Palestinians, and that's the real nature of much of what's going on. I wonder where might we start with you, Mr. Penn? Where are you falling in this division of opinion?
Well, I said earlier, Mr. Pearl's comments I think reflect the attitudes of Jews of one might say of a bygone era in this country, and that is. What his comments express is some sort of abstracted idea of the Jew, as I said earlier, being rootless and stateless. And it's easy then to move, if one has this abstracted idea of the Jew, to some sort of abstracted idea of terror perpetrated against him. But I think that the state of Israel means surely that the Jew does have a global political role such as he's never had before. And if we're going to try to in some way understand what took place at Munich, we're going to have to see it in that context, in that light, you see. So I simply disavow that attitude about the Jew, what I call that abstracted image or idea of the Jew, you see.
In the Palestinian question, do you accept Dworkin's view that the problem, the political problem that Israel faces, is strictly a Palestinian question and not a question of general relations with the Arab countries in the Middle East?
I think that I accept it within limits. That is, I think there is a problem with the Palestinians, but I think one has to see that problem against the background of the interactions between the Jews and the other Arab nations. You see, but I think that he's on the right track. I think there is an issue there. I think what he's let me put it this way. I think that what he's worried about, and to some extent I can sympathize with him, is that there's unfinished business, you might say, and that one might be distracted from dealing with these concrete issues as a result of what took place at Munich. I think that's what he's worried about.
Well, I take great issue with him on this Palestinian question, because when he says that Israel should not discuss their problems with the nations around it, I think he's just not realistic. The Palestinians are part of the countries, part of Egypt, part of Jordan, part of Syria and Lebanon, and there really is no central Palestinian to discuss the problem with. I think everybody realizes that there is a problem, but you can't discuss it. Even each terrorist group operates separately and individually from all the other Arab groups. And the only people Israel can deal with are the government of their neighboring countries. And it isn't realistic to say they're avoiding this that they're not presenting this issue properly. I also think at the same time he said, which has been said a lot this week, that this issue in Munich was done by militant world revolutionaries, and that it really was just, it so happened that they're Arab ones and they're working against the Israelis, and they could have been from another country and done their revolutionary bit with some other people.
My conversation with Mr. Dworkin made me concerned about this matter. How much latitude is there for an American Jew in taking a position counter to complete support of the actions of the State of Israel?
Well, if I might comment on that, I think Mr. Dworkin goes a bit overboard in indicating that the Jews of America must blindly follow a position taken by the State of Israel. I think that's not true at all, and I think we're obviously free to disagree. Now, I think we must differentiate between disagreement and intervention into the runnings of the government and the affairs of the State of Israel, just as some people are concerned that Israel may be intervening in a sense into the political situation in the country at the present time. I'm a little bit concerned about Mr. Dworkin's attempting to draw a dichotomy between the Palestinians and the Arab countries as such. I think that's an oversimplification. I don't think it's done. In my own thinking, I've been somewhat hesitant or reticent in supporting a position which deals only with the Arab countries. Similarly, I would be equally unsupportive of a decision which said we will deal only with the Palestinians, because I don't think either viewpoint recognizes the power situation as it exists in the Middle East. Obviously, where you have surrounding states with which you're at war, you must seek means of resolving your problems with these countries. Where you have a group of people, and I tend to agree that the Palestinians are a force which must be dealt with. The Palestinian refugee situation exists. It must ultimately be dealt with. I think we've got to find, the Israeli government has got to find, some means of opening communication with these people. I believe that such communications have existed, just as communications have existed with the Arab countries. But I don't think you can deal with one to the exclusion of the other. And I think the view which Mr. Dworkin expresses is not a view which is peculiar to him. I think there's a growing minority and it's still a minority sentiment in the state of Israel among young intellectuals, which share some of the views which he's expressed. And I think that if you'd read this book by Amos Alon called Founders and Sons, Israelis Founders and Sons, it expresses some of these same views. But I think that, again, we mustn't oversimplify. No view in Israel today of any substance, and this includes this minority view which I've indicated, would accept the premise that the state of Israel must go out of existence. Each of the views proceeds on the from the very basic starting point that the state of Israel is here, it exists, and must be ultimately recognized as a sovereign state by its neighbors.
I'd like to pursue this question of support for Israel as a position not only for American Jews, but as a position for people in America generally. The question of how far support of the state of Israel as a concept goes and how it limits political choices. I think that's a very real problem to talk about. I mean, I think in all candor, one has to say that in American politics, whether one is a Jew or not, one is obliged to support, without any real question, the actions of the Israeli government. That's just the nature of politics in the United States. George McGovern is obliged to say after Munich that it's really all the fault of Egypt and those Arab countries, and we've got to do something about the Arabs. And the president is obliged to say that I will support Israel, and the argument in politics in the United States comes down to who supports Israel more. Doesn't that back politicians seeking solutions into an awkward corner? It's a practical problem that has to be dealt with in politics.
If you're directing that question at me, I think any politician who would permit himself to be backed in that corner isn't worth a damn. I would hope that after he has reviewed the merits of the situation and has come to that conclusion, we would say that that was a reasoned conclusion. You know, many of my friends ask me, you know, isn't your support of Israel blind? As an American, do you have a dual loyalty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? We've all heard the question. And my response has been, up to this point, I have found certainly no inconsistencies with my loyalties either to the state of Israel or my loyalties to America or my loyalties to my fellow Jew. And I don't believe I base that on any hysterical approach. I think it's an approach which I have reasoned out for myself. And, you know, we could get into the merits of the discussion about Israel as a democracy in the Middle East, and are the United States' interests otherwise affected? Is this a country which meets certain humanitarian needs which people as a whole should recognize? And I could elaborate on all of those things, but I don't want to monopolize the discussion.
I'd be interested, Mrs. Joshua, in hearing your comments on that. You spend some of your time in Israel.
Yes, but I can't see any difficulty in that either, because one can have several loyalties and they can be both very strong. I think people misunderstand the emotional ties that Jews have with Israel. It doesn't mean that you have to agree with everything. It's just like with a person. You can care for a person very much and you disagree violently. But we have this inside feeling that's very, very strong, and I think it probably takes us back to the first tape. That's why we react very strongly when these things happen, like in Munich. But that doesn't really blind us to when there are problems. And I think Jews are very much aware of the problems in Israel and voice their opinion in many different directions, like in any other government. There is no one Israeli point of view. I think everybody agrees that Israel has to survive and has to watch its security very carefully. But within that spectrum, there are many ideas, and we forget that sometimes, just like in any other people.
I think this might... The question I'm asking might be more a problem for non-Jews than for Jews in the United States, because non-Jews get backed into the position of wanting to be very careful because it's kind of, I guess, a racist thing. But, you know, you want to get into the position of not appearing to be anti-Semitic, and that forces you into a kind of support for Israel in political terms. You see it in politicians in this country. That is almost irrationally blind in its nature, and it's probably more a problem.
It probably is. And, you know, I keep thinking back of something that Mr. Pearl said. I think that when you're comfortable with what you are, you don't have some of these very negative problems, and that there's no end and there's no way out. You accept what you are, and you work with it, you know. And I think Jews in general have this ability, even in a tragedy, to just go on and plan whatever is being planned and continue. I think you notice that in Israel a great deal. Whenever there's a big tragedy happen, people get very upset, but they go right on. And I think this is sort of a Jewish philosophy. Dr. Ben is the one that goes into philosophy. Maybe you can elaborate on that.
Well, I'm really much more interested, frankly, in many of the things which Mr. Pearl had to say at this point. In terms of how the American Jew views himself in relation to Israel. You know, Mr. Pritzig put it eloquently, I think, on a political basis. But if we begin to take a look at the experience of the American Jew, if we look at, you know, how he understands himself in relationship to Israel and how he sees himself in the context of the diasporic history of the Jew. And there are a number of problems that come up that, you know, simply can't be dealt with, you know, smoothly at the political level, one might say, in terms of global politics. Mr. Pearl, as I listened to him, is a voice crying in the wilderness. As I said earlier, that you know, what he had to say represents a kind of generational gap in American thinking, in American Jewish thinking, that is, seeing the Jew as somebody sequestered, isolated, without any hope at all. And so he's amazed, in one sense, at what happened to the Jews in Munich, but in another sense, he's not. There's a kind of inconsistency in his thinking, if you think about what he said. Yes.
But I see I hear what he is saying as a realization of a dealing with his being an American and yet always being seen as a Jew. So that situations
That's
arise.
That's very complicated. Ms. Joshua said she has no problem with this. Mr. Pritzig also indicated that.
Well, he touched on it. Yeah. You did, Mr. Pritzig. We went over it very lightly. That was going to be my next question, although in this limited time I hesitate to bring it up. But it seems to be the essence of the whole matter at this point. We Jews here are Americans, and the two tapes that you heard forever balance off this being an American and being a Jew and trying to work out their allegiance.
Notice Mr. Dworkin's you know, approach to the matter as opposed to Mr. Pearl's. Mr. Dworkin recognizes fully and fervently his Jewishness, but at the same time there's a kind of hesitation, a kind of qualm in what he has to say about Israel's relationship with the Arabs in general, the Palestinians in particular, as if he's trying to work out some sort of moral basis, an acceptable moral basis for his position with respect to Israel. Whereas on the other hand, Mr. Pearl is simply, as I said, crying in the wilderness. You see, they're both American Jews, and really, if you think about it, they both really do have a different approach to the problem of Israel.
In a sense, aren't we always trying to work out this dichotomy within us as Jews? Every one of us is, and I think it's just where you are in the spectrum, actually. One fits on one end and one fits on the other end, but it's how we can synchronize these two ideas mm-hmm. within us that mm-hmm. it's important.
You know, it's very difficult to go back much further for many of us than the end of World War II. And I look at my own development over this period of time and look at the development of the Jewish community of the Twin Cities and of the United States and of the world with which I'm somewhat familiar. And during this period of time, I've seen a growth or a natural cohesion, more or less, in the position of world Jewry, a position which I've come to describe really as the unity of the Jewish people. The incident at Munich shocked many people. It horrified many people. The television sets brought it into their living rooms. But I think that while many people were shocked and many people were horrified, it was for the Jewish people to mourn this incident. Just as they mourned the hanging of the Iraqi Jews, just as they mourned the Leningrad trials, just as they mourned the ambushing of innocent school children in the Galilee. This has become really part of our being. But as Mrs. Joshua says, we go on and we continue and we build. I recently returned, as a matter of fact, a week ago today, from a very short trip to the state of Israel, where the major preoccupation with the people in that country, as with the people in this country, it's amazing, is the situation of the Soviet Jewry situation today and the ransom which is being extracted for human lives. You would think that they have enough problems of their own, problems which have accumulated over the years, certain social welfare, education, housing problems. Their people are becoming a bit uneasy, you know. It's time that we had a little bit more for ourselves. But yet the major preoccupation is, what do we do for the Soviet Jews? How do we alleviate their situation? How do we get them into our country? How do we integrate them? And again, this is part of the unity of the Jewish people, which I have seen develop. And I think as I have seen that unity develop, it has really made better Americans of those of us who live in America. I think it's given a certain rooted feeling to the Jews of America. I think young people have reacted. I think those who came from a European atmosphere years ago and had their problems integrating into American society now have a better feeling. Overall, I think it's been a very positive, unifying experience for us.
I had an interesting sensation out of the Munich tragedy that maybe you can help me to analyze. It was interesting to me that you were talking about how the Munich tragedy was one of those things that was left to the Jewish people to mourn. But it strikes me that one of the things that was characteristic of the Munich tragedy was that it gripped all of America, not just Jews, in a very strong fashion. It was a thing that swept through the country and that people responded to, whether they were Jews or not, with some emotion, and which grabbed our attention and grabbed the attention of the news media. In a way, for example, that the tragedy of the Bengalis never would have, or in the way that the deaths of the people at My Lai really never would have. How come it is that even non-Jews in the United States respond to a tragedy like Munich so much more personally than they do to similar situations elsewhere in the world? What does that mean for the American Jew?
Well, I can't believe that, I would like to believe, but I have difficulty believing, that this situation would have much more meaning, would have any more meaning to the average American than a slaughter of Bengalis in Olympic stadia in Munich. This may be a harsh criticism, and I guess for this reason I really haven't been swept up with the same type of emotion in the Munich situation as others. I feel that much of the reaction is the fact that the television cameras were turned on Munich Stadium. It brought a horror, certain horror into the living room, the same horror which would have existed had it been other people. And it occurred at a time when, you know, people were sitting back. They wanted to see the trackmen or the swimmers, and here they're, instead they saw a horror show, and they reacted with horror and revulsion. Now, if there's any consolation in this whole situation, I believe it's the fact that a situation such as this was brought home to many people in the world. And for the first time, they're starting to think about the condition of man. You know, it's really just another example of man's inhumanity to man. What do we do about a situation like this? How do we say to the parties, you've got to solve your problems, you've got to sit down and talk to each other. Nobody can do it for you. No solution can be forced on you. Start talking, but solve it, because the world won't tolerate a similar situation.
That's one of the points of my question. It is just another example of man's inhumanity to man, in one sense. Well, it's a very special example.
I think that's a little too general. I think that there are certain specific reminiscences, if you wish, which the killing of Munich brings to light. There's a kind of symbolic, perhaps, significance of it. I mean, the idea that, how shall I put it without being too blunt, but that, there isn't much of a premium put upon, Jewish life, I think is a deep and lurking fear which many Jews have, and many non-Jews, I think, recognize.
Certainly the fact that it happened in Germany.
All of that represents. You think that might be part of it, part of your uneasiness?
It might be. I don't know.
I think it could be because, first of all, I think Marv Pritz's idea is very good that you saw it on television, but where we couldn't really understand the killing of the Jews in the Holocaust, I mean, the masses and the quantities and the type of thing, here you had a certain number. It was a small enough number to cope with. And I think it was brought home to people for the first time what it really meant to a Jew, because I think the Jewish people felt very much this was the same type of thing. Somebody just kills you because you're a Jew. And you could see it because they were 11. When you think in terms of 6 million, you can't even picture it. So I think this had an impact on a non-Jewish world. I hadn't thought of it before, but it probably didn't. I was thinking of it as I watched the television, that at least this time you had a way of paying honor to the people, and there was a way showing this, which we had never had before, and I don't know whether you can say that something good come out of this, but actually every one of these events, I think, leads up to something. We said it before, but every one of these Jewish tragedies sometimes adds even in a positive way. I mean, when you talk about the unity of the Jewish people, I think 30 years ago, it wasn't taken for granted that Jews would be as strong as a people as they're now. And I'm not talking about right or wrong right before the high holidays. Now is not the time to do that. But there is some purpose to it somehow, and I think many people feel that way.
Mrs. Joshua alluded to the funeral service, I believe, mm-hmm. which was carried live across the country, a service which I didn't see. And maybe it's appropriate to comment in view of the coming Rosh Hashanah holiday season, a time at which we look back to the past year and look forward to the future, that during the service, throughout the service, there is a prayer said which is called the Kaddish prayer. And this is also a prayer which is said at a funeral by those who mourn. And the last lines of that prayer are, may he who makes peace in high places make peace for us all and for all Israel and for all mankind. And I would think that as we approach the holiday season, we couldn't ask for a better wish and a better prayer.
And I think I resonate to that very much. And I, one of the things that, that concerns me is, however, as an American Jew, with a deep regard for Israel and a deep love for Israel, is the fact that tragedy, this kind of tragedy, which produces deep grief, can lead to a kind of psychological dead ending, if you know what I mean. We Jews have always prided ourselves, on the fact that we've always emphasized the import of justice. And even when justice might mean that we have to perhaps even, and this is a hard thing to say, I'm sure, for all of us here who are Jews, even when it might mean that we should perhaps even try to garner some compassion for those terrorists to garner some sort of understanding of who they are and what they did, you see. You'll notice that, for example, they said very little about the Palestinian Arab problem. Mainly they talked about the 200 or so terrorists who are incarcerated at the present time in Israel. And I found that, you know, I find that fascinating. It's almost as if this act of terror of theirs was in some sort of vacuum. In some sense, it was, in some sense, it was empty, you see. But I think that what we have to do is try to make it, in some sense, plausible. Try to grasp, you know, try to grasp its significance. Not to simply, you know, look upon them as if they were, you know, madmen. I mean, obviously, this this action was staged. It was done with premeditation. It was carefully thought out. The point I think I'm trying to make is that, on the one hand, coming back to Mr. Pearl and Mr. Dworkin, I respond, being of Mr. Pearl's generation, to his, you know, to his revulsion, to his cry in the wilderness. But on the other hand, I see in what Dworkin is saying, perhaps the beginnings of some sort of compassionate understanding of those who are non-Jews, those who surround us, and our relationship to them, and that we shouldn't lose sight of that.
And I guess I respond too very emotionally to this entire conversation of very personal feelings and concerns. And I'm very grateful on this eve of Rosh Hashanah to have you here discussing this problem. These problems, I think, is more appropriate to say. I guess we've only begun a discussion. Certainly not solved anything, but maybe put more firmly our feelings in place. I want to thank Mrs. Herbert Joshua, the Twin City Chairman of the 25th Anniversary Celebration of the State of Israel, Mr. Marvin Pertzik, the President of the St. Paul United Jewish Fund and Council, and Mr. Misha Penn, Assistant Professor of Humanities at the University of Minnesota. And I want to thank you, too, Paul, for sitting in here tonight. Thank you all, and Happy New Year.